Welcome to the Fuller Money, our Fuller Tracy Money audio commentary. Well, I thought I would create this audio as an accompaniment to the PowerPoint presentation I did for the Contrary Opinion Forum in Vermont last week. Well, if you go to the PowerPoint, then you'll see that there's that dollar bill sitting on top of a mouse trap. Well, I went into Google and I said, well, show me images for risk. And, well, I scrolled down a bit and I found this one. I'm always in the market for nice images that could look good in a presentation, but it kind of encapsulates the way people are thinking about the market. Well, if you kind of look around the place, there's some people are long and they're leveraged, and there's others are still in cash, and well, people are worried about a number of different markets, and well, there's this geopolitical tension that we've had for the last 6 months, and that's really been weighing on people's sentiment, and well, people are really asking the question, is the risk worth it? Well, if I were to say to you that that's a dollar bill, would you put out your hand and take it? Well, I don't think many people would be willing to take that kind of risk with their fingers for just $1. But if I said that was $1,000, I think probably you'd have a queue of people lining up to see if they could snatch $1,000. Well, it's a little bit like that in the market, that the greater the potential reward, whether that is because people are very ambitious or because people are looking at what they might be able to make from the market, then you'll have people lining up to take risks. Well, when the risk is weighed against a potential loss of return, then people start to look at it a different way. Well, let's look at a number of different markets in that, framing it in that sort of a question. Well, I guess if I move to the second slide, then well, when I look at the bond market, I still think that the Merrill Lynch 10-year Treasury Future Total Return Index is, well, it's the most important chart in the world. That, well, a lot of people got anxious about the bond market last year, that we had this big pullback. Well, it was the first big pullback that we had in a while, and not least since, since the beginning of QE and also from a high level. But what we've really seen is that since the beginning of 2012, it's been hard to make money in bonds. That you might have been able to buy an individual issue, that you might have had to go further out the yield curve, or you might have had to go into, less high quality issues. But by and large, if you were buying 10-year treasuries, it's been difficult to make money. It's been a very choppy market. There's been some pretty big swings. But on a total return basis, this has been difficult. Well, when you think about it, in a market which has only gone up, in a market where if you bought the dips, you still made money, and if you were 55 years old and you've been working in the bond markets the last 30 years, that you have been incredibly successful by buying the dips. Well, is that still working? Well, if you bought the dip in July or August of last year, well, you've made money since then, that's for certain. But, well, we're back at an important level, that we're back testing the highs, and, well, what is the impetus that is going to push us onto new high ground? That this is still a momentum market, and that, well, we're really at an important junction right now. Well, just on pure technicals, when a market that has been trending remarkably consistently moves into a much larger and lengthier consolidation period, well, you have to think that the interaction between supply and demand is changing. And, well, when something has turned from being easy to make money in to being more difficult to make money in, you know that there's a war going on between supply and demand. Well, there's a lot of people worried about a lot of different risks, but well, the bond markets are where a lot of people have parked an awful lot of cash, and, well, it's not performing particularly well. Well, if we move along to the next one, well, this is the Fed's balance sheet. Well, you know, the Fed has been expanding the size of its balance sheet remarkably. That has had people on edge, particularly the monetary purists. Well, we're getting towards the end of tapering. Well, that's going to happen this month. Well, if we look on that chart and we kind of zone in on the 2011 area, then, well, what we're presented with there is when the Fed's balance sheet last stagnated, that we had a pretty volatile period in markets. Well, I think a lot of people are thinking about that as we enter October, that people are really looking at it and saying, well, the last time the Fed stopped a QE program, that we had this heightened volatility. And, well, I think people are worried about that right now. Well, let's say that we get to the end of October and that nothing untoward has happened. Well, then the complacency of the bulls in this market will have been bolstered even further. Well, I'm looking at the S&P over the very long term. And what you see is that the market had ranged from 2000. This has been an emphatic breakout. Well, when something has been going sideways for 10 years and has such an emphatic breakout, well, then you have to conclude that we're in the very early stages of a secular bull market. Well, it's very easy to look at this market and look at it from the perspective of how much it's gone up in 2013, and so far year to date that this market has still been trending, well, reasonably consistently higher, and think that this is a bubble. Well, there is the world of difference between a market that has been going up for 20 years and then accelerates, and a market that's been going sideways for 10 years, well, in fact, it's more like 13 years, and then breaks out in an emphatic fashion. Well, at the chart seminar, we define a range as an explosion waiting to happen. And the bigger the range, well, the bigger the subsequent explosion that you're going to get. Well, we're getting this explosion, and there's really no evidence yet that it's over. But, well, it's already gone up a lot. Well, you have to know that if you're coming in with new money today, that you're not early. But when you look at the S&P, well, it's paused around this 2000 level. Well, that's a pretty obvious level for it to encounter resistance. It's a big round number. When you were asking somebody at 1950 or 1900 or 1800, where do you think the S&P might go? Well, 2000 is a nice round number, and it's a comfortable level that people would start to talk about. Well, that progression of higher reaction lows that's been in evidence since the end of 2012 is still intact. And as long as that remains the case, well, there's nothing really to, well, people that are in this market and are still long, they've experienced no profit erosion. They have still been buying the dips, and as anyone who's been buying the dips has been making money. And more to the point is that anyone who's been selling the rallies, it's been difficult to hold on to any cash you might make. Well, as long as that progression of higher reaction lows remains intact, then I think people are going to continue to give the market the benefit of the doubt. Well, if you look at the NASDAQ, it's been outperforming. Well, let's say that we get to the end of October, and this market has not pulled back in a meaningful way, and that the market is still holding the progression of higher reaction lows. Well, if you think about how a trend develops, that initially what you'll get is a sharp rebound off the lows as some of the shorts are covered and value investors come in. Well, you go into the wall of worry period where you get this the choppy environment where you get bigger pullbacks. There's still a big argument going on about whether this is really the market can be trusted, but well, people generally start to make money, and on reactions, the market continues to find support at progressively higher levels. Well, that can go on for a while, but generally speaking, as a trend progresses, it becomes more consistent. Well, it becomes more consistent because what you get is the bulls are making money. The people that are bearish are losing money, that a bull market hypothesis will have developed, that people want to become part of, well, they want to join the party. There is this constant move in the markets looking for relative performance. And, well, when you see a market that's been outperforming, well, people want to take part. Well, if you're coming in, then you have to start thinking about the future and how much better it's going to be. And then people start to anticipate. And by anticipating, what people are doing is buying early. And if people who already hold the stock are also anticipating the market would go higher, well, then they are withdrawing supply from the market. And the market tends to trend more consistently. Well, the NASDAQ is about 10, maybe 15% away from its all-time high. And you can't but say that this trend is consistent. that you have these ranges, one above another, and that the pace of the advance has picked up in the last 18 months. What happens if the market does not pull back sharply and we don't get the 10% or 20 or 15% reaction that many people who are not long would have been waiting for? Well, there is the possibility that a market like the Nasdaq could accelerate higher and that we could get all the way up to the all-time high before we then have a much bigger pullback. Well, we'll be tutored by events. And realistically, there is no evidence just yet that this trend is anything but consistent. All you could say is that it's a little bit overbought in the short term, but there is absolutely no evidence that this market has ended. Well, we can say that the market has not yet ended, but does that mean that there's no risk here? Well, we can look at some other things and say that there are indications that this market is maturing. Well, the surge in IPOs last year, well, it lost momentum in January, and that was following the IPO of Hilton and Twitter. Well, we've had a great deal of hoopla over the last few months about the number of IPOs that are hitting the market, but they're not doing very well. That if you look at that IPO index, that realistically, they haven't gone anywhere. So that, well, when markets go up and you have a pipeline of IPOs hitting the market, well, obviously, there's no better time to sell your company than when you can get more for it than it's worth, or at least that you think it's worth. That in order to overcome the inertia, to overcome the step up in regulation and reporting, that you need to, and all those pesky shareholders and demand for a payback that you're going to get when you list your company, that you really do need to be given a premium in order to seek a listing. Well, we've had a phenomenal bull market over the last 4 years. We're at new all-time highs for a number of indices, and well, the number of IPOs is piling up. Well, that suggests that there's plenty of supply hitting the market. Well, if you go to the next slide, you'll see that IPO filings are back to where they were in 2007. Well, of course, this isn't that you've got, you know, the value of companies coming to the market. This is more like the number of shares actually sold. Well, I guess the big one was Alibaba. Well, I guess that's not the right Alibaba. Hold on, we go to the next chart. Well, that was Alibaba back in 2012 when it was delisted. Well, I guess I think it behoves one to remember that this was listed previously. And, realistically, not that long ago. And that, well, Jack Ma has pretty good talent at picking the top of the market. He certainly did that with Hong Kong last time round. Well, Alibaba, having had an initial surge, isn't really doing very much of anything. Well, if we go on to the next slide where we have buybacks, I think that's slide 12, that where you might have the supply of shares is increasing. And IPOs, and we have a pipeline of IPOs, and Alibaba certainly isn't the last one. Well, you have a lot of, sport-minded people interested in GoPro, but that, well, share buybacks is where the rubber really meets the road. Well, 500 billion in the last year has been bought back. And in total, since 2009, we're talking about $3.5 trillion bought back by companies. Well, if IPOs represent a potential source of supply, that share buybacks have been the primary source of additional demand in the course of this bull market. Well, then it is worth highlighting that having been among the best performing sectors, so not only were the companies buying back their shares, but that those companies' shares were among the best performers, that the share buyback index has been lagging the market for the last year. And, I guess there's a pretty good reason for that, that they're getting less bang for their buck. That if you start buying back shares and the price of your shares doubles, that you're going to be able to buy less of them. In other words, you have to increase the number of shares you want to buy back or increase the fund for buying back shares in order to get the same bang for your buck in terms of the improvement in EPS and the improvement in the share performance. Well, it suggests that that's also a mature phase. Well, of course, companies are sourcing that income from the bond markets. And, well, where we're going to see a hiccup there is if anything happens with that very first chart I showed, which is the total return bond index. Well, I'm moving on to slide number 13. It's the Russell. Well, again, the Russell is a market that had trended remarkably consistently, and it really hasn't gone anywhere this year. That, well, small caps are interest rate and credit sensitive. Well, we're watching this level here, and, well, it looks to be at least a medium-term range, but it could potentially be a top. Well, when we start to see that buybacks are underachieving, and that small caps are underachieving, well, then you look at the NASDAQ. Well, I guess the NASDAQ is a... well, it's representative of large cap growth. That, well, look, people are looking at large caps to outperform. But again, that is also a late in the cycle phenomenon. Well, if the Fed is, I'm moving along to slide number 14, and I see this man with a big ladle and full of cash in his hand, and I'm thinking, is this Mario Draghi? That the Fed is approaching the end of its taper. Well, the ECB, and I'm going now to slide 15, the ECB has drained €1 trillion out of the system in the last 18 months. Well, Europe has had the luxury of being able to debate whether it should be engaged in quantitative easing or not, or how much additional supply it should provide the market. And part of the reason for that is because they have been able to access, well, unlimited cash via swap lines with the Fed. Well, as the Fed moves towards at least a neutral policy, that the ECB will have to start taking responsibility for its own monetary affairs. Well, it's for that reason that Mario Draghi, since the summer, has been talking about engaging in quantitative easing. It's also that he's been receiving a lot of resistance from certain elements within Germany in particular. Well, one of the reasons that the that the euro has been so weak is because people are starting to price in that the ECB will engage in some form of bond buying, and that the aggregate liquidity will improve. Well, you have to think, why does the Eurozone have such deflationary pressures? Well, you don't have to look very far when the ECB has taken €1 trillion out of circulation. Well, one of the reasons that Swiss, German, Finnish, Danish, Dutch, Belgian, and Irish two-year bonds are trading in negative yields, though this isn't a spread, on slide number 16, that you're seeing the German two-year trading at a yield of minus 0.69%. Well, basically, people are saying to the German government here, I'm going to pay you to take my money. Well, I guess part of the reason for that is because they are betting that the ECB is going to continue to support the market, and that activity is going to translate into some form of quantitative easing or a revival of the LTRO program that saw the balance sheet expand by €1 trillion in 2011. Well, it's also why the euro has been so weak. Well, I'm on slide number 17, and, well, here you have the historic euro. Well, I guess you can call it the Deutschmark, because before the introduction of the euro, they've just filled in the back history with the Deutschmark. And, well, what it shows us is that the dollar hasn't been this weak ever. That the dollar bottomed in 2008, and that, well, it has type 2 base formation characteristics. If you look at that range, you have a progression of higher reaction lows, but it hasn't really gone anywhere. Well, we've had a big move in the euro recently. It's gone from about 134 to 125. Well, the eurozone needs a weaker currency. And, well, you can't really talk about a strong currency or a weak currency unless you talk about it relative to something else. Well, with the Fed's balance sheet about to stagnate, at least the expansion is about to stagnate, the ECBs could be on the verge of reversing. And, well, that's a powerfully bearish outlook for the euro. But it's a little bit oversold in the short term, so we could get some steadying. Now, next slide would be number 18. Well, that's just a shorter term, and it definitely looks like a base formation to me, and I really wouldn't question that hypothesis unless you see a significant move below 140. Again, for the on that Deutschmark chart. Well, a lot of people, I'm looking now at slide 19, would have been looking at Japan 18 months ago, and they would have been saying that, yes, the yen is going to get weaker, but that you can't buy the Japanese stock market unless you do it on a hedged basis. Well, it must be a little, you have to come to the same sort of conclusion when looking at Europe, that Europe needs a weak currency, that the euro is well on its way to getting weaker, and that the chances are that you are going to see the European index outperform in nominal terms, but that probably the best way to do it would be on a hedged basis. That, well, what we're seeing is that people are going to have to pay a much closer attention to currency market performance. Well, when you think about the actions of Japan, and you think of Europe, and you think of the US, and how all of the central banks have got, reasonably similar policy, but often competing against each other. Well, I wanted to look at, well, where are we in terms of the global monetary picture? Well, it's certainly helpful to know just how much money there is out there. Well, you know, when there's a lot of money and money is the supply of money is expanding at a rapid rate, then it's easier to make money. Well, what I did was I went and I looked at the Fed's balance sheet and the ECB's, the Bank of Japan's, the Bank of England's, and the Bank of China's. Well, I converted them all into the same units and the same currency, or rebased it to US dollars. And, well, the conclusion is that, well, the pace of the advance on this trend has picked up, that the amount of money from those five central banks is approximately $15 trillion. And that, well, it's been losing momentum a little bit in here, but there's nothing to suggest that the trend has changed. Well, if that's the case, that the Fed might be tapering and the ECB might be turning around, and, well, China needs to reinvigorate its economy, and Japan is, it's going full bore to court inflation, that, well, there's not going to be a dearth of money, but that we are moving into a position where there's going to be a little bit of a chop and change. Well, not least in terms of the gap between when the Fed ends its taper and the ECB picks up the baton. Well, going to slide 21, that if you think about it, governance really is everything. And the heightened geopolitical tensions that we've had over the last year really helped to emphasize that. Well, if we think about, you know, a lot of what we see in the media is about where governance is deteriorating, but India represents a country where governance really is improving. Well, I had a meeting with somebody in the corporate finance department, well, I guess the corporate treasury, at a NASDAQ 100 company in 2012. Well, in those sorts of situations, you don't ask them anything about their company because they won't tell you anyway. What you do is you go along and you say to them, what about your competitors? How are they doing? Well, what he told me was, and I thought it was a great example, that the corporate treasurers from all the California-based NASDAQ 100 companies, they go to a meeting about once a quarter to talk about corporate finance and how they're managing their balance sheets and their risks, and that the topic of India had come up. Well, this is in 2012 now, remember. Somebody had said that they had decided that they were going to invest in expansion in India, that they were going to move some operations over there, and that after spending a great deal of money, they were pulling out. And part of the reason for that was that the cost had exploded because of the rent-seeking from bureaucrats, that they were ending up paying up to three times as much for the plant and machinery and permits than they had expected. Well, they described India not as a country, but as an acronym, that India standard for I'll never do it again. Well, that'll tell you just how bad the sentiment towards the country had gotten. That last year, what people were talking about were it was the safety of women on the streets, and the country was on the verge of collapse. Well, then you get this election, and you get the first person that isn't from the ruling classes elected, and in a landslide victory. Well, the first single-party majority government in nearly 50 years. And he's going on an anti-corruption ticket. Well, the market has broken out. Long consolidations, and this one was only 7 years, but again, another emphatic breakout. Well, you'd have to look at it and say that this is a new secular bull market. That the standards of governance and the expectations for India were so remarkably low that, well, he may not achieve everything that people are anticipating, but that all he really needs to do is to clamp down on the bureaucracy and the bureaucratic corruption in order to really create value. Well, I suspect that he might be able to do considerably better than that, but that this represents a bull market, and that a market that has been going sideways and has just broken out, well, it can go up more than many had expected. Well, inevitably, you're going to get some form of consolidation once the initial euphoria has run its course and people start to ask the important question as to what really happened, or has anything really changed. And, well, we might see some consolidation of this move, but that, well, provided it continues to hold the breakout, you can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the medium-term upside. Well, the banking sector has been leading to the upside, and, well, 40% of Indians don't have a bank account. And, well, there's an awful lot of them, so that represents a considerable growth opportunity. And, well, I guess the banking sector has been going through growing pains over the last few years, clamping down on corruption and improving the outlook for GDP growth could help that a lot. Well, in an environment where the dollar has been firm, well, the rupee has been reasonably steady. Well, it's going to be progressively difficult if the dollar is rallying for more than the short term. It'll be difficult for a country like India to maintain the stability of its currency. Well, it had been trending lower since 2008, it really went from 40 to 70, and well, that was That was pretty impressive volatility. Well, what we can probably anticipate is that we're moving into more of a period like that from about 2002 to 2008, where you get this rangy environment that the high up there close to 70 is probably the high for the dollar, and that we're probably going to get ranging below it. Well, provided that the currency is reasonably steady and that people aren't losing both in the capital market and the currency market, then, well, the outlook for India will be pretty rosy, but I think a lot of people will increasingly be looking at these currencies. Well, the Matthews India Fund, the talk was in the US, and, US people want to know how they can access some of these markets from abroad. Often it isn't that easy. But in the UK, I guess people have a lot easier time of investing in foreign markets. Well, it's been a difficult 6 years for Brazil. I'm now on slide 26. Well, the bull market from 2003 all the way to 2008 was just golden. That the market rallied consistently and the real doubled. Well, we've moved into a more difficult environment since then. Well, Dilma Rousseff has been in power, and she hasn't been imaginative in reigniting growth as commodity prices have deteriorated. Well, the rally that we had in the summer was on expectations that she might lose yesterday's election, and, well, the pullback that we've had in the last 3 weeks has been on expectations that she would win the election. Well, I guess what I said last week was that we're going to find out, and what we found out yesterday was that Marina Silva was pushed into third place. Well, I think a lot of people were worried that the loss of support that Marina Silva was experiencing last week was going to translate into support for Rusev. Well, that wasn't the case at all. That most people went from supporting Marina Silva to supporting Eunicio Neves. And that, well, the market has rallied really quite spectacularly. Well, we're going to have additional volatility for the next 3 weeks. But that, well, the prospect of a growth-minded government moving into Sao Paulo could represent a really powerful move. And it would represent another administration entering office on an anti-corruption ticket that, well, they're looking to improve governance in a country that really has been, well, where there's been just a dearth of governance for the last few years. Well, moving along to the chart of Petrobras, well, the market trended lower with that rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs between 2009 and this summer. And well, it's rallied to break the progression of lower rally highs, and we're now getting some consolidation of that. Well, I believe the share was up about 20% in here today in Germany before the Brazilian market opened. Well, you can see that Petrobras has essentially been Rousseff's piggy bank, and that any prospect of her leaving power is being viewed as a net positive for the share. Well, we'll know in 3 weeks, but that it's going to be a tight race in all likelihood. Well, if we move on then to Japan, well, Japanese small caps are still trading at a price to book of 0.8. This isn't an expensive market. Well, the small caps measured by the second section index have, well, they're prone to big moves, but when they start to rally, those rallies tend to be very persistent. And, well, if we look at the Russell and we say that small caps are interest rate sensitive, small caps are sensitive to availability of credit, well, while the Russell has rolled over that, or at least lost momentum, that the second section is benefiting from all the same factors, but that Japan is nowhere near ending its quantitative easing program, so that should still be a net positive for the small caps. Well, I'm showing this really long-term chart of the yen because, well, I think it helps to highlight that, yes, we did have a big move in the yen in 2012, and that, well, the dollar has really only completed its first major consolidation of that breakout in the last 3 weeks. That we could see that the dollar rallies substantially from where it is already, and that that is going to represent well, improving competitiveness for Japanese exporters. Well, the DXJ, which is the hedged ETF in the US, is an interesting proposition because, well, it is now more focused towards tracking the JPN 400 rather than the Nikkei 225. Well, that new index, which has really only been around for the last 8 or 9 months, has an ROE qualification. So that, well, companies that aren't returning equity aren't getting put into the index. And what it really is, a governance index, and it is, well, giving some weight to the types of companies that should benefit from the weak currency. Well, if we look at China, and well, that's China is slide 31. Well, everyone at the moment is talking about what's going on in Hong Kong. Well, if we think about it like this, that the Chinese must have learned something from Tiananmen Square, that moving in with tanks on groups of students is really not a smart thing to do. Well, they might be many things, but they're not stupid. So what we've seen in the last day and a half is that the number of people out protesting has, well, has gone down quite a bit. That, well, in all, well, Hong Kong is one of the most commercially minded places on earth, and that anything that hits the bottom line beyond the short term is what really starts to focus attention. Well, you also have some of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square movement telling people that they need to take a rest, that they should be playing the long game, and that they should negotiate. Well, that's pretty positive. that the chances are that level heads will prevail. And that's important, because if we were to have an unruly or, well, most particularly a violent breaking up of this opposition or this protest movement, well, then that would really sour perceptions about the market. Well, this is all happening in October. What's much more important is that the Hong Kong Shanghai Exchange opens up in October. Well, it represents a wall of money that mainlanders are going to have access to Hong Kong and international markets via those foreign companies listed there, and that Western, well, not just Western, but, well, foreign investors are going to have access to the mainland Chinese markets via Hong Kong. Well, Hong Kong's a net beneficiary. And, well, it probably hasn't escaped the attention of a lot of people that the A-share market in China, or the CSI 300, is probably the best benchmark because that's the one that has futures. Well, it's rallied to break a five-year progression of lower rally highs over the summer. Well, there has been some to and fro in Hong Kong because of this, well, democracy rally, but that, well, this is providing us with a buying opportunity if the tensions continue to ease. Well, for a U.S. investor, the CHN has been an interesting proposition because it's still trading at a discount to NAV of 10%. And that, well, it yields 2%, but that in each of the last 4 years, it's paid out an extraordinary dividend of 10%. Well, that this closed-end fund doesn't really look like the Chinese market, does it? And that what we've had in the last week or two has been just a pullback and consolidation. Well, that if you look at the slide 33, that the red chips, which are Hong Kong listed China affiliated companies, well, that it continues to have this rangy uptrend, that we've had some pullback over the last couple of weeks, but that we're probably now being presented with a buying opportunity, that it's back to the progression of higher reaction lows. Well, interestingly, when we discussed this environment in the chart seminar in Chicago, well, there was plenty of people said that they'd be much more happy to wait, that if this really is a big deal and if this really is something that is going to change the outlook for China, that they would prefer to wait for a breakout before they participate, because they just don't know which way this Hong Kong thing is going to go. And, well, there's certainly merit to that argument as well. Well, I've really focused on places where governance might be improving. Well, if we look at slide 34, well, you got to think that you look at the ruble and you have to conclude that governance is not improving in Russia. Well, on the off chance that the Russian situation were to ease and that they were to embrace, well, respect for their neighbors and, well, really not just going out to stoke nationalist fervor in an effort to, well, tape over some of the cracks in the administration, well, then the ruble would steady up. But, well, there's just no prospect of that at the moment, that they have someone in power that is just not interested in improving governance. Well, you look at the continuous commodity index, and what, well, it broke down last week. Well, there's still an argument as to what's going on, as to whether this, whether the commodity bull market has ended. And, well, you must think that some of the investment banks conclude that the bull market is over, for the simple reason that they have sold off warehouses, they've closed desks, they've fired analysts, they've reduced their headcount. Well, previously, and particularly from 2002 onwards, the investment banks accumulated those assets so that they could take both sides of the trade. They were able to affect the market because they had the warehousing and they also had the trading. Well, if they're closing desks and firing sales forces, then the liquidity within the market is going to deteriorate. Well, that means then that commodities are going to go back to trading on their individual merits. That, well, cocoa prices are rallying because of the Ebola virus in the primary production area of West Africa. That feeder cattle prices continue to rally because there just aren't enough of them around, following the droughts of the last few years and the high price of grains, that farmers are racing to rebuild their herds. But that when you look elsewhere, that what you're presented with is an environment where the supply of commodities has increased substantially, and that the growth expectations on which that supply was based haven't really improved. Well, this index has broken downwards. Well, it's going to have to turn around in a hurry, but that realistically it would need to break the progression of lower rally highs to even begin to suggest that the impetus is back on the demand side. Well, if you look at slide 36, then what you're looking here is at a nice index produced by the Fed. I guess I haven't seen anyone else really looking at it, and probably because it has got such a long name, the U.S. Trade Weighted Real Other Important Trading Partners Dollar Index. Well, I don't particularly like looking at the dollar index because it's all euro and yen. Well, I can just look at the euro chart and I can look at the yen chart to give me an idea of what the dollar is doing versus those currencies. I'm more interested in finding out what it's doing relative to everything else. Well, what this index is compiled of is the Mexican peso, the Brazilian real, the renminbi, the rupia, the rupee. It's a lot of emerging market currencies. It's a lot of commodity market currencies. Well, the last time it was updated was the end of August. I'm waiting for it to be updated. And, well, it'll be an interesting chart because with the strength that we've had in the dollar, well, this could be breaking back above the 200-day moving average. But even on the data that we have right now, that this downtrend has lost momentum. That the dollar hasn't been this weak since the 1970s. Well, we know what happened in the 1970s, that it was a period when commodity markets did very, very well. And that subsequently the dollar was substantially stronger. Well, the dollar's pretty weak. That if commodity prices are coming lower, that it is representing a major challenge for a number of emerging market economies. And we can see that those that are embracing improving governance, they have some of the firmer currencies against the dollar, and they have some of the more impressive growth trajectories. And those are the types of places that people are going to want to be. But what we also see that in Russia, that they're not embracing improving governance, and their currency is deteriorating rather rapidly. Well, you can't simply now bet on emerging markets, that each one of those markets is going to have to be weighted on their governance characteristics, that governance really is everything. Well, if we look at oil prices, that Brent crude broke below $100 last week, it's down to test the lower side of that range. Well, I guess oil is one of the most geopolitical of all commodities. So I'm looking at slide 38. Well, this is a really interesting chart. Well, it says quite clearly that in order for Saudi Arabia not to have to dip into its savings, that it needs oil around $100 a barrel. Well, we don't know where Russia sits on this table because it's an OPEC table, but that the lower oil prices go, the greater the pressure that will be put on despotic regimes. That some of these countries like Kuwait and Qatar aren't going to have a great deal of problems when their cost of production, and in order to balance their budget, that they can survive around $50 to $60 a barrel. Whereas when you look at Iran, Nigeria, Iraq, Ecuador, that if they don't get oil prices above $100, and in many cases substantially above $100, they're going to be under pressure. Well, that suggests that we're going to have greater geopolitical tension, that despotic regimes will try and paper over the cracks by stoking nationalism, getting themselves into wars, and that those that are improving, that have improving governance, will go the other way, that they'll seek peace, that they'll try to improve the lives of their citizens, and in and by doing that they'll create GDP growth. Well, if we move along to gold, that we're at $1,200. It's at the lower side of the range. Well, if it's going to rally, it really would want to be getting about it. That there's a lot of people thinking that gold is going to go to $1,000. And, well, you do need to see that upward dynamic. Well, we saw some of that this morning. But the conclusion that I made last week was that, well, do you really need to own gold? That if the stock market is moving into a new secular bull market, that, well, the Dow gold ratio has turned, that it went from 45 to 5, and that it's now around 15, that it's broken the secular downtrend, that you would expect that stock markets will outperform over the long term. And that really does mean that gold is no longer a buy and hold investment, that it is a trading vehicle. Well, it's oversold in the short term. Well, this might be a time that one would start to look at it as a potential buy, and that gold will have occasional cyclical bull markets, but that, well, something really meaningful would have to happen on the demand side to get this back into a secular trajectory, and that by and large that it's going to be more of a trading vehicle, but that it is oversold in the short term. Well, silver broke down, but it's equally, and this is slide 40, that it is even more oversold. Well, even in a bear market scenario, that there's the prospect that having been down for 10 or 11 consecutive weeks, that it could go back up to test the progression of lower rally highs. Well, on slide 41, that, well, the Australian economy just really can't tolerate a strong currency any longer. That this is really what we're seeing with the Canadian dollar, what we're seeing with a number of other commodity currencies. That the likelihood of the highs being taken out that were posted in 2011 is pretty unlikely. And that we're moving into a much more choppy environment. Well, that is basically where I finished off my my talk, that when you look around the world, that we're at a very interesting trajectory, that there is the possibility that Wall Street, well, particularly the Nasdaq, could accelerate higher. Well, that if it does that, we're going to move into a much more choppy environment when the acceleration is over. That we have improving governance and the prospect of major bull markets taking hold in some of the world's major population centers, but that where governance is not being embraced, that there is the prospect for really a lot of volatility and a very difficult environment indeed. That we're in a mature stage in the wider bull market, but that there's no evidence just yet that it has ended. Well, I guess I've talked for long enough. I hope I kept it within the hour. I struggled to do that in Vermont as well. And I thank you for your attention.